Oh, I guess I forgot to put the intro on. Whoops, here we go.
Yeah.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners, on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, good, very well. How are you doing?
I'm doing very good. We missed you last week, but we had an excellent show with Dr. Jen Hawk, so we welcome you back, Dr. Lyle.
Yeah, too excellent. That was fabulous. It was the only Beat Your Genes episode I've ever listened to, because I can't stand the sound of my own voice. So, but I listen to Jen Hawk all day long, and that you guys did a great job, and I'm so glad that our listeners got to just hear her wind out, because it's a great treat to just listen to her thinking and just listen to her talk. It's great stuff, Nate.
That was a lot of fun, and we want to reassure our listeners that Dr. Lyle's not going anywhere. We're not replacing him. We're just adding Dr. Hawk to the show.
Very good. All right.
All right. All right. So the questions for tonight's show.
Sure.
Yeah. What we've got today is this is a question about Dr. Lyle. So you, as a psychologist, you have talked before on the show about something called CBT, which stands for cognitive behavioral therapy. So this is the question about this. So, dear Dr. Lyle, I've been listening to the show for close to 2 years now, and I've enjoyed seeing the world through Dr. Lyle's lenses, and now additionally Dr. Hawk's. I was wondering how Dr. Lyle reconciled two seemingly opposing thoughts that I've heard on separate episodes. Number one, that CBT is an effective therapy to mitigate cognitive distortions. And number two, that the human brain and nervous system does an immaculate job of evaluating its effectiveness and status within a group. If our brains do such an amazing job of evaluating feedback from the group, why are cognitive distortions so common?
Really good question. So let's see if we can understand. Let me take a big sweeping view so that we understand the nature of life and what the mind is up to. So the nature of life for an animal is for the animal to make the best possible moves, obviously for gene survival. So we are replacing that slightly. We have a slight modification of that in human life, and that is that we're trying to essentially optimize our happiness or our life experience as opposed to gene survival. Those two things are highly correlated, but they're not 100%. So with that being said, it would be let's skip over that very important detail as we follow the logic down to understand distortion. So the any animal's understanding of reality at any point in its life is distorted. So a fox doesn't know where the rabbits are. It has a guesstimate about where the rabbits are, but it's not sure. And so it actually is operating under a distortion. In other words, it doesn't know the exact concentration of rabbits on the 3 acres to its left versus the 3 acres to its right. All it can do is get an estimate. It may even have them rank ordered properly. It may know that there's more likely to be rabbits on the 3 acres to the left as opposed to the right, but it doesn't know how concentrated. And what it doesn't know is that the 3 acres behind it are actually more concentrated than the ones on the left. So you're always operating under distortion. The what Aaron Beck noticed with a very simple little feedback check looking at depression 50 or 60 years ago. I think it was the 1950s. He was a psychiatrist at the University of Pennsylvania. And he decided to do something very simple. I don't actually know how this was born or why he did it, but he asked depressed people to sort of write down their thoughts about things. And he believed that he noticed in their reports that their thinking seemed to be distorted. And he thought, you know what? I think that they have an unrealistically negative view of themselves and the future and the world. I just think that they're just generally negative. And so then he thought to himself, well, maybe I ought to try to tell them that and sort of knock some sense into their head and point out to them that I actually think that their thinking is distorted. And so he did that, and he seemed to have some success. And that's the dawn of cognitive therapy. Now, you might say, wow, that's the big revolution and revelation. It's like, yeah, but it seems like that's what, of course, people have been naturally doing forever. So it's like, well, gee, I don't think I'm ever going to get a girlfriend, not after Susie dumped me. It's like, hey, well, listen, kid, you know, there's always somebody else that's going to come along. You know, next year there's a new class of freshmen, you know, and you'll be a junior. So you're a little more cool than they are, and maybe you'll get a shot at one. You know what I mean? So obviously the process of human beings talking to each other and reasoning through challenging situations involves the attempt to try to, under ideal circumstances, both people are attempting to minimize distortion. And so a good friend is listening to a friend's possibly distorted inferences and attempting to correct those with more realistic information. So that's cognitive therapy. I mean, it's got a fancy sounding name, cognitive therapy and cognitive distortion, but it sort of deserves it. In other words, we could actually drop the word cognitive, because what other kind of distortion would there be? All right. So obviously it's a mental process of estimating the truth. So it would have to be a cognitive distortion. It couldn't be any other kind. Now, and then Beck was sort of reasoning things through. Now remember, this is the backdrop against the two twin grand theories of psychology that are sitting outside of this are psychoanalysis, which has its own view of essentially distortions and how it is that people come to be depressed. And, you know, it's got its own deep, conflicted Freudian mourning and melancholia, you know, crap that he cooked up. And on the other hand, you know, behavior therapy or sort of behaviorism doesn't really have anything to say about this. And so this was, the humanists had their own ideas of various kinds, but which made quite a bit of sense. In other words, Carl Rogers is inferring that people are sort of short of positive regard and that they need positive feedback. So that's what he's thinking, and which has some truth in it, obviously. We see the seeds of esteem dynamics in that thinking. But Aaron Beck is coming along with something that is very sort of engineering style, very matter of fact, very, you know, he's a psychiatrist, but he's not succumbing to psychodynamic crap. And he's also not succumbing to the prescription from behavioristic science at that time, saying you can't look at the phenomenology of the individual. You know, to behaviorists, to asking people their opinions and why they think and feel the way they do, it's like, oh, no, that's not what we do. We just watch their behavior. You know, forget about talking to them. You can't do that. That's going to be misleading. And Aaron Beck, fortunately, was in a department of psychiatry instead of psychology, so he wasn't being browbeaten by the Skinnerian dominance of the time. And he says, no, I'm very interested in what it is that these people report. I think it's important. And it looks to me like they are unrealistically negative. And so now what I'm going to do is my new, quote, therapy is going to be to essentially reason with them. And let's see if in fact they're making incorrect inferences about the data that they've seen and why it is that they're making the inferences that they're making. And let's see if I can change their mind. And if I can change their mind, I believe that the reason why they feel the way they feel is because they think what they think, and that their feelings are a derivative of their thinking, which is absolutely true. Okay. So then there was, you know, fights in the literature and in emotion theory between people like George Mandler and Richard Lazarus at Berkeley. There's people, some people saying, oh no, feelings are before thoughts, and Mandler saying, no, there has to be thoughts before feelings, and argue back and forth in the hotty-totty literature of early cognitive science. And it's, you know, obviously true. And I think another Robert Zients was a big guy saying, oh, no, feelings come first. This is all total bullshit. The obviously information processing comes first. And, of course, these guys couldn't possibly understand, because they don't have a sophisticated enough theory about how the mind works at that point. So, of course, what the mind is doing is it's analyzing data. It's a computer, and this would be finally brought to the fore by Tubby and Cosmides, who explain that the mind is a computer. It's not like one. It is one. And it's running computations on gene survival, and it has algorithms for essentially coming up with value assessments. And so what's going to happen is that it does the best it can, given the data it's got at the time and the algorithms that it has to run them. And obviously, this is way past Aaron Beck writing in the 50s, and it's way past the cognitive therapists and the cognitive therapy that you see today, because they don't understand any of the stuff that we talk about on this podcast. But the concept of distortion and the questioner's question is, yes, CBT was the first real basic mechanical observation of saying, listen, people's feelings are a derivative of their thoughts. And they actually came up with a name for the thoughts. They called them automatic thoughts. And I would go further in saying that where they just said, hey, they're just automatic. But actually, they wouldn't have known that the thoughts are coming or emanating from deep algorithms, that the organism has no choice as to think what it's thinking. And so the thoughts themselves lead to inferences about the nature of the person's relationship between self and reality. And then those inferences give rise to feelings. And those feelings are prescriptions for action. That's how the organism is designed. So the cognitive therapy model is, hey, if you're getting a lot of depression in your feelings, it's possible that this is unnecessary and that it's actually a derivative of distortion. So they recognize that if your cat dies and you're miserable because you just have a loss, hey, that's a loss. But if you are depressed because you feel like you just got fired and you'll, quote, never get another job, if that's what's coming out of your mouth in front of your therapist, the therapist can say, well, now, wait a second. You're saying that the way you think right now is that you'll never get another job. And interestingly enough, maybe that is kind of what you think, even deep down into your gut, is you're feeling like you're, you know, in other words, the unconscious thought processes are giving rise to a verbal report that says, I don't think I'm ever going to get another job. And the therapist says, okay, well, let's just pause right there. Let's examine that for what they call whether or not it's rational. In other words, is there an alternative hypothesis based on the evidence that we have? And so it's a mechanical method of therapy that says, let's see, what evidence do we have that that's true? How many times have you been hired before? Well, 6 times. And then how many times have you been fired? Twice. Okay, so that you were fired on your second job, then you got 3, 4, and 5 job, then you got this job, then you got fired from this job. What makes us think that 6 is all there is in the hopper for you? 6 different times somebody said that we will hire you. So what makes us think that there won't be a 7th, an 8th, and a 9th? Okay, so essentially pointing out the fact that the individual can be making an inference that isn't supported by the evidence. This is what cognitive therapy is. Now, so, and it's pretty good. It's the best thing that's been shown, okay, up to this point empirically for a wide variety of psychological ills. Now, I believe, of course, that it can be radically improved if it has a more sophisticated model as to the nature of distortions. Cognitive distortions are, of course, what it is that we're attempting to reduce in any kind of therapeutic process, because distortions are the source of mistakes in the person's or the animal's decision-making. That is the source of error. And errors lead to failures, and failures lead to bad things. So, the rabbit running from the fox, who thinks it should turn left right this minute and it actually should have turned right, pays for it with its life. It made a mistake. Okay, so the person that goes to Las Vegas and thinks that they're going to win and puts their family savings down on, 16 red on the roulette wheel, if there is such a thing, that individual has a distorted view of the probability of success and what that would mean. So distortions are what it is that we are trying to reduce in order to improve the decision-making of the organism, which leads to better outcomes, which leads to a better existence. Okay? So cognitive therapy is a relatively crude but straightforward and relatively reasonable approach towards attempting to reduce distortion. Now, the second question is to say, okay, well, I brag about how sophisticated the mind is and how it works extremely hard at trying to figure out where the person stands vis-a-vis the environment. So how does that square with the fact that distortions exist and that cognitive therapy is potentially, or any kind of therapy, is a device or a technology to reduce distortion? Well, first of all minds are operating under distortion all the time. It's just a matter of how much distortion. So I I'm not even wild about the concept of therapy, because it has a bizarre connotation to it that harkens back to the reparenting of the Freudian and neo-Freudian, and current psychodynamic thinking, which I think is, haywire at the core. Because we don't need to be reparented. What is necessary is to make the mind more accurate. So it's the removal of error that's going to help us. We're attempting to fly a jet here. And so the least error we have in our computer systems and the least error we have in our understanding of engineering will reduce the likelihood of people being dead. Okay? So the whole point is to, what therapy is, isn't therapy. It's learning, for God's sakes. Okay? It's improving the mind's understanding of its environment. And so there's several ways that the organism can come about by having distortions that can be reduced through education. So let's look at one. So basically, life experience will cause you generally to have your distortions decreased. So you will, as you're born and as you grow up, you start to understand the context of the world and your place in it. You figure out that there's people other than your parents that know stuff, and a lot of people know a lot more than your parents about a lot of things. Well, you don't understand that when you're 3, but by the time you're 13, you do. Okay? And so you start to find out that there are assets out in the world that you didn't know about, and you also found out that there's liabilities out there that you didn't know about. And so as your brain is learning details of the environment, you're essentially like a fox that is, been shipped into a new territory and dumped off, and now you got to learn the whole landscape. You got to map that thing out there so you know where the swamp is and where the snakes are and where the rabbits hang out and everything else under the sun. You're learning. And And the more you learn, the more accurate your understanding of the environment, the more effective your behavior is, because the less errors you make. Now, so your life experience, i.e. the data that you have in your head, helps you be more accurate in how it is that you approach the challenges of life. So it can be easily the case that individuals have had a relatively a strange looking data set has come their way in their life experience, and it will tip them either overly positive or overly negative. And that that data set, which is inevitable, okay, think of a list of random numbers. And random numbers have patterns in them that get people all excited. This is the fiasco of stock market analysis. Okay, the notion that we're going to see patterns there, and we'll run correlation coefficients, and then we're going to bet on it. Okay, a person can, for example, and you will hear this, they'll have two or three things go wrong in a row, and they're thinking that they have bad luck. That this isn't their day, or it's not their season, or whatever the heck that is. And it's not, this isn't the way it is. It isn't necessarily at all. It likely has their failures or their negative feedback has causes. Those causes are unmysterious. They may not be identified. But an expert may be able to identify what they are. And therefore you may be able to change your odds by understanding the roots of why it is that you've experienced failure. So your experiences, I had a person that had a company go south on him, and he was completely flabbergasted by this because his previous company had been very successful. And he actually believed that the reason his previous company was successful is because he was smart and hardworking and honest and decent. And I explained to him, no, that isn't why you were successful. You're successful because you're smart and decent and honest and hardworking and lucky. Okay, so you forgot the fifth variable.
Magic sauce.
Okay, what's that?
The magic sauce.
the magic sauce, exactly. Okay, and so therefore, you know, this was important, and he had not actually understood the nature of the competitive realities of that marketplace well enough to really dig into the probability and statistics. And as a result, that's why he took a chance in the first place. It's because he was overly optimistic and believed that hardworking and decent and honest and smart was going to be enough. And it's like, well, he lucked out. Good for him, okay? But it set up a distortion in his mind and in the people that invested in him the second time around that he had the special sauce. And it's like, no, he didn't. He had all the variables that anybody has for success, except the second time around, he didn't get the fifth variable that would be critical. Okay? So therefore, quote, therapy is going to be about a sophisticated education about the nature of, by listening to people and understanding what they're thinking, we try to get clear about what inferences they're drawing from the experiences that they've had. And we try to figure out whether those experiences are actually, and the inferences that they're making from those experiences, are actually mapping onto the competitive realities that actually await them in further interactions with the marketplace. And sometimes they don't. Sometimes the person is, let me give you just an example that it's not a great example, but it is an example. So let's suppose there's a young lady that's struggling in the dating world, and she's carrying around 20 extra pounds. Now, because she herself doesn't mind if a guy is 20 pounds overweight or not, she just can't seem to feel like it would be that big a deal. So she's pretty, and you see that she goes to the hair place and has beautiful hair and has beautiful makeup and has beautiful clothes, and yet she can't find the magic 10%. And so she's like, God, you know, what's the deal? And so she's got a distorted view because she's sitting inside of a nervous system that has a bias built into it because it's a female brain looking at the problem instead of a male brain looking at the problem. And so she actually doesn't understand just how many chips she's leaving on the table. Okay, so that would be an example of someone who, it's not like they don't know that there's that it's not an issue, but they can underestimate the issue and how much variance in their success is going to be riding on that variable. So that just is my entrepreneur underestimated how much luck had to do with success in his endeavors. Now, some people may be thinking that this, for example, the luck issue is a jaded view of reality. It's not. Publishers understand this finally after a century of misinvesting in what they think is a great book. Okay, they finally realize it's a waste of time. For new authors that we don't know what they could do, what we're going to do is we're going to give thousands of authors a shot at it and put a little tiny bit of money on each one of them, and then that's the right algorithm. Rather than us huddling around a table and saying, well, we think this one is really good, so we're going to put $250,000 behind this one, and that's the right way to do this because this is a great book. It's like, no. That is not the right idea. The right idea is to publish, 15 books, give each of them 15 grand publicity, and that gives us 15 shots at something we don't see coming. That's how the publishing industry works. Okay, so they've done that because any other model has fallen flat on its face. So the idea of an old editor in the 1940s, looking at a couple of books and scratching their chin and really deciding which one to bet on, yeah, that's over. That model of decision making is now buried by a much better understanding of the essentially the unpredictability of success. So it's not jaded to say that you could have a distortion in your own understanding about the causes of success and failure in a given domain. Now, so your personal experience can have been biased, and you could be therefore making it would be very honest for it to be biased. In other words, you don't understand the situation. You've looked for a correlation. You believe you see a pattern, and it looks like there's a pattern, but actually the law of small numbers has got you, and you don't understand that it isn't the way you think it is. And so this is where the mind, despite its magnificent capabilities, can be limited in its ability to make accurate distortions. And so a wise person that knows the landscape better than you know it can actually educate you and therefore reduce your error and therefore help you. Now, another source of distortion is personality. So if you can imagine that probably the least distorted personality, if you were to imagine this, would be an extraordinarily bright person, with a personality that went right down the middle of the big five bell curve. So they're neither no open, no close, or 50th percentile, 50th percentile conscientiousness, their 50th percentile on introversion, extroversion, and agreeableness, and on emotional stability. That individual would have exceptional insight into how other people are likely to react to things, because they themselves would have the least distorted position from their own egocentric bias to be looking at other people's behavior and anticipating what they're likely to do. If you were a highly conscientious individual, you would be more likely to make mistakes and inferences about other people's behavior, what it means. So for example, somebody that agrees to do something and then flakes out, you might infer, well, they don't really like me and they're disrespecting me, et cetera, et cetera, when really they're just kind of flaky. They're just a 35th percentile conscientious human, and you didn't understand that, and so therefore you're overreading what you think you're seeing there, and you're making a mistake. So you can see that the further you get away from your fellow man in terms of your view, the more likely you are to make mistakes. Now you might say, well, shouldn't an average Joe then, average IQ, be in the best position? No. The more brains you have, the more computing power you have, the more capability you have to make the least errors. And so you undoubtedly open up some error variance if you're exceptionally bright, because you will sometimes overestimate what other people are capable of doing mentally. So that channel opens for error. But generally what you would want, if you were trying to build a superb coach for humans is you would put that person exceptionally bright and then right down the middle of the big five. So personality, anything where a person is away from the mean, this is another source of distortion. So now we're seeing the two major sources of distortion that leap out at us. One of them is environmental and the other one is genetic. And so any human thought, feeling, and experience is nothing other than an interaction between environment and the genes. So we would expect to find two sources of error in the system. One of them would be experiential, i.e. the database is distorted, and the other would be the underlying architecture of the system, i.e. the genes are distorted. So you can, a great example of a hyper-conscientious person having distorted genes would be a hand washer that's washing their hands 80 times a day, okay? Or an anorexic. So these, there were germ phobic of various kinds, airplane phobic, whatever, any kind of high anxiety individual, you're looking at a nervous system that is overestimating the worst case scenario. So this is an example of how the genes are driving distortions, and therefore they're driving error and they're driving unpleasant fallout as a result of that error. If you were, for example, not very conscientious and extremely open, then those distortions would lead you to take risks that seem reasonable to you, but then will very likely wind up in tragedy. Okay? So that's the other way that it works. So another source of distortion for a mental process would be chemical. So if you've got drugs in the system, alcohol, etc., or sleep, or actually possible injury, a brain injury. So any assault on the integrity of the neural architecture in any way is going to add distortion to the mind's ability to make estimates of its nature of relationship between self and environment. And this is why alcohol is called liquid courage. In other words, if a guy is going to go up to a woman at a bar and he would be anxious about it, it's a good idea to down a couple of scotches and dampen down the anxiety. Okay, so that's why that works that way. That facilitates that process. Okay, now another source of distortions is going to be the mismatch between the world that we find ourselves in today and the world that the neural circuits were designed for. So the pleasure trap is something that comes to mind. So the pleasure trap in all of its guises is a way for the organism to get a distortion and therefore make self-destructive decisions or costly decisions as a result of that. The ego trap is another trap where the modern environment can extend the ego trap's reach. Instead of being a short-term social phenomenon, it can turn into a lifetime or a long-term mess. You also have other situations in the modern environment. So you've got this social pressures and expectations around romantic relationships that lead to marriage, et cetera, et cetera. So that's another host of problems. You also have the anxiety and high sensitivity to the notion of bad news. And so you have people worried about burning issues. You also have people worrying about, essentially overestimating the likelihood of tragedy happening to them because they're seeing tragedy on the news, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a Darwinian distortions are a set of distortions that can be encoded into the system because they're evolutionarily useful, but they are distorted. So, for example, if you hear a twig snap in the woods, the first inference you make is predator, even though it's exceedingly likely to be wrong. So it's an adaptive distortion, but it's a distortion. It's not distorting the CB on what would be the highest and best use of the organism's musculature at that moment. In other words, it should get ready to run every single time it hears that thing, even though it has no additional evidence that it might be a predator. So the system was shaped properly in order to run that motivational calculus. But when we look, we see that it's quite interesting how the inference that the organism is making, the phenomenology of the organism is, oh shit, what's that? Okay. And if you were to ask a person its estimation of whether or not that's a predator at that instant, its intuition is, God, it could be 1 in 5. When the reality is the real likelihood is 1 in 5,000. So anyway, the long and short of it is the mind is exquisite and brilliant. It's running all kinds of data analysis to try to give the person an accurate view of the situation it finds itself in. However, the situation it finds itself in is inherently very complicated, and the individual themselves is born with inherent individual differences that make it have a distorted computer. And so as a result, its experiences also couldn't possibly be a fair sample, a perfectly unbiased sample of what life is going to be like. Okay, so as a result, as the person goes on in life and has more life experiences, they get increasingly better calibrated at the likelihood of you know, tragic failure versus grand successes. And so this is why eighth grade boys, by the way, 85% of them believe that they're going to be professional athletes. Okay, so 8,499 of them will be wrong out of those 10,000. Okay, so the one of them, 1 in 10,000, will be. So it's no tragedy that the other 8,499, you know, have to face. They just have to face a recalibration, a removal of the distortion that they're sitting on as eighth graders. So that's the very long answer to what is actually a great question about the nature of distortion, cognitive therapy, and you see now, in as I go through the distortions, you're seeing a more sophisticated view of the nature of the generation of distortion than you would have in cognitive therapy. Cognitive therapy doesn't understand anything about behavior genetics. That's not part of its playbook. And it vaguely would understand that experiences would drive distortion. It wouldn't know anything about Darwinian distortions. And it would certainly recognize chemical distortions, and if they were thinking about it, in which they're not. So but cognitive therapy, I recognize it as a cousin to what it is that I do. It's a distant cousin that was a forerunner of what I consider, you know, cutting edge modern clinical psychology, which is which is essentially cognitive therapy that is embedded in the biological consilience of evolutionary psychology.
Absolutely fascinating. Dr. Lau, you said it was a long answer. It's 40 minutes, but all I have to say is I missed you.
Jen could have said it in 15. But,
well,
it
nothing against Dr. Hawk at all. She knows how much I adore, you know, and enjoy hearing her talk. But, you know, we miss these long explanations. It's really complete.
All right. What else we got?
All right. So our next question is perfect timing because you were talking a little bit about this. So dear Dr. Lyle, I've often felt anger when someone seems to misunderstand something, perhaps honestly or perhaps disingenuously, in something that is approaching an argument. The feeling often keeps me from explaining exactly what I mean because I just expect that the exact points of the disagreement are disingenuous, so it won't matter and I will only regret justifying myself and, quote, opening up. You've often mentioned that communication in relationships isn't faulty the way most psychologists say, but you've also talked about getting crystal clear. So should I beat my genes and get crystal clear in these cases, or is the inference that it won't change a thing correct?
Okay, we've got two as I see it, two very different questions. And I think that they're being molded in the questioner's head. So one of them is going to be the nature of anger and argument in general. The other is going to be the nature of repeated anger and argument within relationships. That's a whole different issue. Okay. So the so let's begin with the nature of argument. So the way this person is tracking their internal experience is admirably accurate. In other words, as soon as we begin to sniff an argument, we pick up cues that the person is starting to use tactics, either in the logic of what they're using, or it could be in any of the five communication channels. So it could be facial expression, body posture, touch, voice tone, or the words themselves. So any way you slice it, we're picking up cues that they are intending to win. Okay, now, it's going to turn out that the reason why we're angry is that we believe that that they are not playing fairly. So we can sniff that they're not going to play fairly. So this is clearly an ancient game theory dilemma for humans when there's a disagreement. So what will happen is people, if you start to pick up cues, and the cues are, when I talked about the magnificence of the mind, one of them is, what are we talking about and what is the social context right now? What seems to be the point of dispute? And is something about this, are they aiming for some resources here to take them away from me rightfully in some fashion? And that they're going to try to wangle to get these resources. So they're going to be treating me unfairly. And which means that they are essentially inferring in some fashion that they deserve these resources and that I don't deserve them or my share of what I believe my share is. So there's that those resources could be esteem easily. Okay, so it could be like, hey, listen, don't you know who I am? I blah, blah, blah. Okay, so this is, and what I believe to be the case is that in these essentially resource allocation disputes that took place in Stone Age villages, that when there was a disagreement, notice how voices rise. They do not remain at the same level. The decibel intensity increases. This indicates to me that the arguers were attempting to display their irritation that they are being egregiously cheated and that they want to draw attention of other members of the village because they're going to want to have a jury. And then what happens is that, like, let's suppose it's, no, you told me that you were going to give me 5 coconuts for that carving, and now you're coming with 3, and that wasn't our agreement. Okay, I can already feel myself like I've never even been in this situation. I'm already getting hot under the collar. Okay, so the point is that you can feel like, hey, no, this is what our deal was. Okay, and so you can feel that anger starting to happen, and what we're doing is that we're bringing in a crowd. Okay, and we're attempting to win this thing very quickly. Because the crowd is not very interested in our dispute. They are vaguely interested in our dispute, and our increase of our voice tone is a signal to the village that we need, you know, we've got a dispute here between two village members, and we need a jury, okay, to decide this, because we've got a disagreement, and we aren't going to resolve it. So somebody's going to have to back down, okay? And so the jury is going to decide who needs to back down, who isn't playing fair. And so as a result, what's going to happen is, what I notice in human argumentation is that people do not play fair. They go, they use rhetorical tricks. They go right for the jugular. They give biased samples of the evidence. They conjure up ancient history with respect to that other individual that has nothing to do with the current pattern, but is, you know, tangentially damning. And as a result, this is what, when you start to smell that the person on the other side is going to dig their heels in and that they're going to go to the mat on this dispute, you feel the same. This is game theory. Okay? So game theory says, don't let them steal a march on us. I can be just as shitty as you can be. Okay? And in fact, I can remember when I was a little kid, I don't know, I was having some problem in kindergarten or I don't even remember. There was an old guy named Mel at this auction in downtown Long Beach that we'd always go to the auction because my dad was really cheap and he just loved the auction. He'd get things for, 10 cents on the dollar. And there's an old auctioneer named Mel, of course, is just tough as an old boiled owl. And my dad was would have been a young man. I would have been five. Well, my dad was 35. And Mel was an old tough guy. And there was some discussion about, me and some fight at school that, of course, didn't happen, but could happen. And I was worried about it. And my dad said, like all good, responsible, conscientious men, well, you don't start it, but you finish it. You know what I mean? And so I was clearly had some kind of anxiety. And Mel said, no way. No, you hit him first. Okay. It was just this sort of striking contrast in strategy, okay? And my dad cracked up. He's like, yeah, okay, let's think that through. That's not necessary. If we think a fight's inevitable, you go ahead and hit him first. And so, not that this ever happened in my life, but it was an interesting sort of moral sanction from the elders in the village. Like, hey, don't get hit first, then you're at a disadvantage. So similarly, argument clearly works this way. Go ahead and hit first. Hit hard. Okay, sucker punch him. And so you can feel this. If you didn't have any better evidence of this, look at the presidential politics that have been going on for the last several years. It's unbelievable. Like, it's all about hitting sideways, seeing when they don't see it coming, as hard as you can. Okay, so the person's sort of knowledge that they can see, hey, wait a second, I find myself getting angry. That's right. That's your internal signal that you're being treated unfairly. And you're going to threaten them that they better back off or there's going to be consequences. Okay, that's what's going on. So obviously that's not going to happen too much repetitively with people in your environment unless you've got some boss that's constantly asking you to stay overtime and you're not in a position of power to tell them to go to hell. Okay, so usually, but you may have some mother-in-law that's just always irritating you because we've got this kind of a situation and it's repetitive. But now you understand what's at the root of this. Normally, we wouldn't have a repetitive problem with somebody unless what we have is a disagreeable person on the other side of the equation. And a disagreeable person by genetic nature has a biased view as to what's fair. And so they're always feeling like our offering is not adequate. And therefore, they're snarling at us that we're cheating them. And then we can, in the early game, we may feel guilty, but after repeated exposures to this, it's like, no, you're out of line. And we feel ourselves rising to the occasion to try to defend our time and our energy against someone who has unreasonable demands. So that all being said, that's the explanation of the anger mechanism and why you feel what you feel, because you are caught in a game theory dilemma. As soon as you sniff that somebody's going to treat you unfairly in a negotiation, you can feel that you better defend yourself. So now, in a relationship, if this is happening consistently over time, we got a serious problem. Now, a therapist, of course, modern therapist doesn't have any idea why anybody's angry, okay? They think it's, hurt and that there's bruises from the past that remind us. God knows what they think. They're just convoluted messes, okay? No. The bottom line is that if you have anger, it's because you believe that the other party is not treating you fairly. If you're in a relationship where this is a repeated issue over time, this is not a communication problem. This is a personality conflict. Okay, this is not fixable. The arguments that you're having are Groundhog Day. they're happening all over again. Next week, the week after that, 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, two Sundays out. It's like it's always going to come up because there's no underlying fix for this. The reason it's happening repetitively is the other person is not reasonable or we're not reasonable. And the interaction between those two individuals gives rise to this dynamic, and that dynamic is not fixable. Okay, now, the so what I will argue is that people are actually exquisitely good at communicating in relationships. Now, let's suppose we have people who are actually quite happy a lot of the time, and then they have an argument, okay? And it's pretty bad. And now that's different, because what can happen is that these instincts that say, hey, I got to win, okay? And people can feel like what's at stake here is when we start arguing with someone close to us that we generally have trusted, that we believe that they value us at a certain level. And now the negotiation, the inferences that we're making about the nature of this negotiation are that no, we don't feel that way. So I have a friend of mine who's, you know, has really a terrific marriage, but he himself is pretty touchy. And the wife is a saint, okay? But every once in a while, she will call something, give him feedback that she believes is fair and reasonable. And, you know, if it hits him the wrong way, because he's pretty touchy, he can really go off. He can get really upset. And so she, you know, she's not trying to teach him a lesson, but every once in a while she just trips over it. So he's, you know, he's a 70th or 80th percentile disagreeable. She's a 20th to 30th percentile. In other words, she's super, very, very agreeable. So in general, they are in an equilibrium and the relationship works. But every once in a while, it tips that way. And incidentally, it's always that way. It's never that he accidentally over-insults her. Yeah, I mean, that never happens. The blow-ups that they've had over the years are always the same direction. It's always the disagreeable human has gotten, you know, the agreeable human has given what she considers to be reasonably honest feedback about something, and the disagreeable has all been out of shape, okay? Now, fortunately for them, this doesn't happen often because they're essentially in an agreeable-disagreeable equilibrium. So when you have something like that happen, what we have to do, so if it's the relationship's important, if the stakes are high on any dimension, what we want to do is we want to do crystal clear. So what crystal clear is taking a specific dispute and being very careful about how we question, you know, what message are you trying to say here? What exactly are you trying to say? And so when usually, between two partners where the where we're not talking about a dispute that has now turned itself into a mushroom cloud of essentially a vicious cycle. So the relationship, a good relationship's in a virtuous cycle where we're sending the same signals to each other and reaffirming our desire to be in the relationship. When you're in an argument, you feel the things start to spin the other way. And the human instinct's desire to win the argument can start to move us into a vicious cycle, okay? I.e., you're treating me unfairly, so I'm going to go for the jugular and go after you unfairly, okay? And then the other person sees that, and they're like, oh, boy, well, then I need to defend myself in terms of my reputation in the clan here, so now I'm going to go after you, okay? So that sphere can very quickly spin into a vicious cycle. It's so fast, it can happen literally with one comment or even a smirk. Okay, that's how sensitive people are to which direction that particular dynamic is running. Okay, so crystal clear is a way where what we're going to do is by very careful questioning and allowing the person to express themselves and not interrupting them and challenging them. What we are going to do is that we are essentially diffusing the Stone Age instincts that says, I have to hurry and win this argument very, very fast because the jury is only going to listen to this for about 3 minutes and then they're going to render judgment. Okay, it's like, no. You go right ahead and I'm going to ask you why you're saying what you're saying and why you're thinking what you're thinking and why you're feeling what you're feeling. And I want to hear the whole context. So when I said this, that really upset you, tell me why. okay? And then we let them talk and talk and talk and talk and talk, and we do not, and we ask them clarifying questions. Now, very often, just by doing this, sometimes we will, as we're listening to this, we will hear the distortion area. We'll hear that they're making inferences and they're drawing in data to that theory that is incorrect. Okay, but we wait. We don't dispute it then. We let them get the whole story. So that's step one. They tell their whole story. Step two is we feed it back. Okay? So step two is we say, okay, so when I said this, then you said this, and that's because you felt this and you were thinking this, and then we had that situation before that was kind of similar, and then 5 years ago, you know, this happened and I made a comment at your mom's place, and you think that's related to that, and you think that's related to that, and this, that, and then you're thinking this and you're thinking that, and so now you're thinking that this is really what I meant and this is really what I'm thinking, and you're thinking that this is what it means about what I feel about you. Okay? So we get it all out and we feed it back. And what you're going to see when you do that is a relief on the person on the other side. They were feeling the Stone Age panic that they weren't going to be able to make their case. And not only do we let them make their case in exhaustive detail, we feed it back to them and make sure that we've got it right. And very often they'll correct us. Like, no, that isn't quite what I'm feeling. What I'm feeling is this. Like, okay. So then we feed it back again. So by the time we do that, there is what they start to infer on the other side of the equation is that we're not in a vicious cycle. Okay, it's a tremendous signal to the person on the other side. We are not in a vicious cycle. Okay, that in fact, I care enough about what you think and what you feel, and I'm worried about what it is that you, where you think and I'm coming from, that I need to understand it, and I'm going to take exquisite detail in my understanding of this. I'm going to get it so that I understand you really well because I'm super motivated to understand where you're coming from. That's a huge message to give somebody on the other side of the table. Okay? That's how we stop the vicious cycle. Okay? Now, the next thing we do, if we are... if you can learn this and map it out, you can do it mechanically too. It doesn't, you know, you can do this. You can learn this as a couple. If this happens once a year and it's really tough on you, then you can learn this and you can say, let's do it this way. And your instincts won't let you do it. You won't want you to do it, but you can. It's learnable. Okay. It's a way to, as we go back to the first question, it's a way to learn how to reduce your distortions. Okay, so you're wired by evolution to have a distortion about the other person's motives and to actually throw distortions into an argument that makes you more likely to win it in order to defend your esteem, i.e. whatever resources that you have at play in this thing. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to, you know, really get careful about the analysis of the problem to remove all possible distortions. Okay, and then... before we're going to come back and we're going to tell the person where it is that we believe they're distorted, we're going to contextualize the whole situation in a way that is going to start to spin it in a virtuous cycle, which is where we want this thing. And that's that we're going to bring back the context and we're going to tell them a whole bunch of things about them that we find super valuable. So we're going to flood the circuit. Okay? Then the next thing we do is we say, okay, here's how I see it differently than you. Okay, I agree here, I agree here, I agree here, I agree here. And I agree that when I said that, I was kind of pissy because I was hurt. But this is what it is that I was really thinking, and this is what I'm worried about, and this is how this went down. Okay, so this is how it is that... you know, if we're motivated and we've got actually a very good relationship, but we will have occasionally threats to that relationship that can get scary. You know, so if you had a big fight yesterday and yet these are two people that care a great deal about each other, the fight itself isn't an indictment of the relationship. But what we got to do is we got to suck it up and try to, quote, communicate very effectively in ways that beat the genes. OK, okay? Because when people are angry, they'll send defection cues. They're threatening. They're really raw and worried, etc. So that can happen. Now, my explanation when I say that therapists do not know what they're talking about when they think that the cause of the problem in relationships is communication problems is because long-term recurrent conflicts of interest in relationships is evidence of personality conflict. It's not evidence of problems in communication in the relationship. Okay, this, what I'm talking about, is the way you more quickly and more effectively repair and get better at the fact that relationships, because there's a lot of chips on the line, can have some scary moments, and that this is how it is that we can transcend those and not essentially cause more misery than we need to. It's a way of thinking through how to remove distortions as surgically and as humanely as possible. That's what this is.
Dr. Lyle, absolutely fascinating. We love it. We're going to keep that third question for next week. We're going to have Dr. Jen Hawk on again with
you. Very good.
So, Dr. Lyle, as always, we love it. So thank you again for coming on. We'll look forward to speaking with you for more questions next week.
Fantastic, Nate. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.